All right, everybody, welcome back to Antifada. We are talking to longtime friend of the show, Malcolm Harris, author of Kids These Days, Palo Alto, and now What's Left? Three Paths Through the Planetary Crisis. But first, I wanted to do a little farmer's market check-in. Malcolm, what kind of seasonal produce are you enjoying this week, and what are you making with it?
Ooh, great question. So one of the farms near me does this deal with boxes of little produce. So I get all these little squashes, and it's like $3 a box for these little squashes. But they taste better, I think. So I just made for lunch, I made a squash and tomato and white beans on toast sort of deal.
Oh, nice.
Like a summer squash all the time these days.
A ratatouille.
Ratatouille, right. Like the little mouse.
Is that what you made? You made a ratatouille?
I think maybe it qualifies. I'm not sure with how beans are involved or whatever, but the summer squash is really the core of the dish, and that's what the ingredient I definitely want to shout out.
Are you getting those little like yellow ball shaped squashes?
Yeah, I get those. I get the like round zucchini shaped ones that sort of look like little hand grenades. You get the ones that look like flowery sort of deals that look decorative, but they taste real good.
Yeah, you realize you were so close to making succotash, which, as I understand, is like a new world, like complete meal or something. It's like a
I just need the corn, right? And I've got the corn. I should have put in corn. I robbed my family of a full protein.
You've basically taken food out of your child.
Idiot.
But it is summer corn season, right?
So I've got some ears in the fridge.
Am I being put on the spot now?
Are you eating any vegetables at all, Sean?
Oh, absolutely. I am being put on the spot here. I did not prepare for this question. I would have done my reading, but I didn't. We don't have CSA, but what we do have is an excellent 24-hour green grocer up the street from our house. And these days, what's been in season and really good has been strawberries and also various stone fruits. So nectarines, peaches, and little mini, plums, little mini plums. So this summer in my, as I recover from my ailment, which is a broken elbow, I've tried to swap out one meal out of the day with just eating fresh fruit, which I think is good. It's like nice and it's healthy, and I'm just sitting around the fucking house, so I might as well try something new, right?
Oh, yeah. I've been rocking some Rainier cherries, just popping those in throughout the day. Wonderful snack.
Hell yeah.
And cherry I made a wonderful fennel slaw recently.
Ooh, nice.
Okay.
Nice. You got fennel in your CSA. That's fancy.
Lots of fennel. More fennel than I care to admit. All right. We got the farmer's market check out of the way. Now, check. Let's...
I could do the whole hour and a half on that. Yeah. If you guys, you just let me know. I could...
This is your third time, right? I think. Is it second or your third time on the show?
Well, you got to have me for once every book, right?
So I think this is your third time on. The third time a guest is on, we always grill them for a long time about which produce it is that they're really into.
Much as we always grill zucchini and corn when we get the chance. So, exactly. So your book is about the hope that we can continue having you on for many years in the future and having vegetables to eat, having a fertile planet in which we can enjoy the fruits and veggies of shared earth. You know, when I first picked it up, I thought it would be sort of like a Three Futures kind of thing, but it's not exactly that. It's sort of like your analysis of these three different concepts of what we're going to do about this planetary crisis, and then you sort of weighing in on them. You think that's more or less fair?
Yeah. I mean, one of my goals, I had a set of goals, but I think one of the goals was to give people a good account of what the whole left field looks like in this present moment. And I center it around, we could say, the climate crisis, but I think the concept of what I'm talking about is bigger than that, because it's about how do we get control over our social decision-making. And the climate crisis is like maybe the most egregious example of us failing to get control over our own planetary society. but it's definitely not the only one. I mean, we should think about it like expansively. And it's kind of a bummer to me that the like publishing media world silos these things so completely that like a climate book is a climate book. And it's like, mm-hmm. well, it has a lot to do with economics, obviously, because that's, you know, the mechanisms that we're going to use to address this climate and stuff. But yeah, so I'd go through what I saw as the three even like analytically viable strategies for how to deal with this moment that are left-wing and or progressive. And I tried to do my best to give the strongest account of each one that I could. So I wasn't making like a partisan case for one of them, which is an interesting intellectual exercise for me because I had to argue for things that I don't necessarily think are the right answer, but there are strong arguments across the field.
Yeah, so those three strategies are market craft, which is sort of like Green New Deal, solar panel, government regulation of bringing a green market into existence, public power, which is government ownership of the energy sector for a green transition, and then the third one is communism, people seizing the means of production. And yeah, I was interested in seeing how you dealt with these three things, because I, just knowing you and knowing your work, I know that you're going to tend towards the third solution, but you were very sort of fair to going through those three arguments. And I was wondering while I was reading it, was the point of that because you do think there is a lot of validity to those first two, or was it sort of this is a popular text and you're trying to convince people that might agree with those first two strategies?
Yeah, it's funny. If the last part was my strategy, if it was like a rhetorical sop where I was like, please come in and read this book, people who don't agree with me, like that seems not to have worked very well. I don't think I've gotten a lot of liberals to like pick up the book and think through it, which is too bad because I think I really do give a strong account of what they believe. And I think even a stronger account than most of the liberals themselves give of their own strategy. So that's a bummer. For me, it was like when I originally planned to write the book, it was going to be oops, all communism, right? That was going to be the only strategy. It was going to be about like a value form approach to the climate crisis and how something that shatters the value form is the only way to approach the crisis in an analytically viable way. But the more I like thought through that, I decided that that wasn't true. Like that other people have stories that they tell about how their strategy is going to work in this situation. And that I had to at least like respect those enough to try and work through them and think through them and not just say like, why I think they're wrong. Because also I had to admit that my strategy has all sorts of problems too. And that looking at this moment, we're in a state of indeterminacy about like where to go and what strategies to align behind. And I don't think in the relevant period that we're talking about, right, which is not that long, I'm not going to convince everyone to become a communist, everyone who's going to like be useful and do useful work about this planetary crisis isn't going to just like agree with me over the next 20 years. Like the odds of that happening are very low, which means for me to argue that that is the only solution is very unrealistic, right? Everyone's going to say like, well, that's not going to happen, so I don't have to listen to you. And that they would be like right to a certain degree. At least like my story of how that happens would be wrong, and I would know it would be wrong. And instead, if you think historically about major moments of progressive change, the left field always involves a bunch of people doing different things strategically, not just tactically, but people who are working under like fundamentally different strategic concepts, and they don't all win. Like someone usually ends up closer to one than the other. But when, in order for change to happen, you need to have some sort of conjunction, some sort of not unity, but a coordination or some sort of clicking together of these three different strategies.
And so do you think that these strategies do work with each other, or do you think they sort of end up in the same place? Because, you know, the way I read the book is that it's good for you to walk through market craft and public power in terms of their looking at their best arguments, looking at their logic, understanding ways that they do or could work and ways that they're very limited. And it also makes sense not to really critique it, because there's, to me, there's no real point in critiquing those from like a revolutionary perspective because they stay within the bounds of capitalism. And I think capitalism's destruction is really the only solution to this planetary crisis.
Yeah, but I think capitalism's destruction, odds are, is not going to look exactly like we imagine it to. And I think that there are arguments like even within the market crash section, which is like a liberal strategy, the people who are arguing for like the socialization of the investment function, right? Like Saul Omarova or whatever, like, is that like still a capitalist strategy? Like, well, yeah, it involves the investment of capital. That's true. It involves like the existence of the wage relation. That's true. But it's a significant change to the social relations underpinning the capitalist mode of production, such that you can imagine a scenario in which those kind of reforms within the system lead to the disintegration of capitalism itself. And I think that people who believe in those strategies, some people who believe in those strategies would argue that way. That's like, look, this is about, you know, strangling capital to death slowly over this period of time. And we're going to, at the end of that period of time, capitalists no longer possess the social planning function, which is, I think, maybe what distinguishes capitalism as a like historical epoch, right? It's not that capitalists have never existed before or capital's never existed before. It has, but the class of capitalists control the question of the distribution of social resources, the investment of social resources. And some market, I think radical market crafters would say, we're trying to find a way out of that situation with these tools that we have in front of us. Do I think that's going to work? Do I think that's how they're going to like characterize this transition? I don't think so, but I think that like that's going to be an important part of the situation in which we're going to be dealing with, right? Like hopefully, right? If no one can figure out any of that, then we're all screwed too.
I think there's a very generous way to read this book and what your project is, and that maybe takes parsing maybe the definition of what we mean by socialism or communism, which is to say like communism isn't like something that we wish to impose upon the world, but it's based on precepts in existence. You give all of these different policy proposals that market crafters have come up with, public power policies. As I think about it, and I think you would agree, Malcolm, and I know Andy would too, what's essential is that the working class itself take control over society through a party, through its organs, through revolutionary unions or whatever it is. Once the working class itself is in the driver's seat and once capitalists and capital has been subordinated to this process, call it the dictatorship of the proletariat, whatever you want to call it, then the proletariat itself is a revolutionary subject. And so whether or not you're implementing reforms, as long as the end goal, the horizon, is the destruction of the value form, you might be putting in place reforms around public power, around nationalization or socialization of various different industries, that like as long as there's a proletarian party in control and a true one, moving towards socialism, then it's still socialism, if that makes any sense. And I want to say that to cue up a question, right? Which is, Malcolm, in your book, you give good examples, whether it's in terms of autos or whether it's in terms of green technology, of really existing workers' organizations, which is to say trade unions, especially in the United States, being resistant to sorts of changes, both market craft and public policy. So talk a little bit about this tension and how it's reflected in your research.
Yeah, I use Joshua Clover, IRP's formulation of the affirmation trap mostly to talk about this under the public power section, which is that workers and organized under the official labor movement have a contradictory, sometimes contradictory, two sets of interests. That you've got in your interests within your workplace, where you're fighting for maybe control over your labor process, but probably more for wages and for laboring conditions, and trying to improve them, and as well as trying to like find more work for yourselves and your coworkers. But then you also have a class interest, a social interest in the destruction of the exploiting system itself. And those interests find themselves at odds a lot. We can think of a bunch of examples of, especially when it comes to the building trades, which is a powerful sector within the official labor movement that we have today, but it is also like deeply interested in growth as such, right? The capitalist growth as such, because they're the ones who build the buildings that house capitalist growth as such. And so one example I talk about in the book in New York State is a bill that came on Kathy Hochul's desk that was going to ban new gas-powered Bitcoin mines, like cryptocurrency mining operations. And that's like, you know, the lowest possible bar for social planning in the public interest right now is like, don't do the like class inequality mining machine using fossil fuels, right? Like that's the only thing produced by cryptocurrency is class domination. And like, we shouldn't just like burn gas to produce class domination if we can prevent it. If we can do anything to prevent it, that's what we should prevent. And like, you know, a working class interest is very clear on this question. But the building trades in New York also wanted to build those buildings. And that's not a like a fake interest. That's an interest they have as particular workers in particular places doing particular jobs that you can't just like replace generically with some green job somewhere else, right? Like those are jobs that you might not be able to replace the quality of the compensation easily or some other way. And you see like the unions fall right into that affirmation trap of saying like, no, we need to build the Bitcoin mines because those are our jobs. It's our job to build the mines. And there's a tendency on some parts of the left to say that the organized labor movement can only be failed. It can never fail. Right. And so that like in that situation, it's the fault of, you know, professional managerial leftists for not understanding that like those workers need those jobs or want those jobs and like get out of the way, or, you know, fit your political understanding to the organized working class such as it exists, because that's the only vehicle for social progress or whatever. And I don't think that's true. I think there are like contradictions within every one of these strategies, and not contradictions that you can solve in a pat way and just say like, oh, we figured it out. The answer is to back this social force instead of that social force. But to look at like particular situations where you're going to have these conflicts. And sometimes the answer is like, no, the official labor movement is wrong. We should ban gas-powered Bitcoin mines, even if that's a like, you know, liberal policy reform signed by Kathy Hochul and like pushed by environmental nonprofits funded by billionaires or whatever. It's like still a very good idea, right? Or still like a basic level good idea. And so, yeah, part of the exercise of the book and my attempt to be very fair with each of these strategies and giving them, you know, each one gets 5 sections about why it's really good and 3 sections about like, here's some of its problems, is to think through those contradictions, which I think are like relatively evenly spread throughout this left field.
I'm kind of curious to hear your follow-up on that, Sean, because you're sort of in the midst of the remnants of the Green New Deal Build Back Better program. And then, you know, maybe next year you'll be building some Bitcoin mining or AI type place.
Yeah, and I'm not sure they're going to put those in, you know, the midst of the most expensive real estate in the world. But yes, I guess I would travel. If the economy got bad enough, I would travel upstate to build the Bitcoin mines. I guess in like the remnants maybe of Indian Point, our old
right.
plant, which RIP passed away several years ago due to politics. But no, my reaction as I was instantly thinking of it, and Andy, I think you were close to it, is that the bottom has really fallen out for us in terms of private infrastructure. For the first time in the history of our local, as they tell us at union meetings, we have 0 private foundations in Manhattan going up. That's wow. Not just a reflection of, I think, the commercial real estate and development economy right now. I think it's also the strength of non-union and those private jobs from us. So, and I've been speaking about this on the pod here and there for a while, what you have the building trades becoming, and this is reflected in the work generally that's available, including the last job that I was on, is large public works infrastructure programs and green energy stuff, which we've been pretty essential in doing. So like it kind of solves the problem if you get private capital and like build and like commercial and residential buildings out of the union purview and you just make it about infrastructure, because then it's like all we're building is what the state tells us to build. And so if the state, Governor Hochul, you know, is making this big push, I think similar to what Malcolm talks about in his book, this big push towards statifying or using the New York Power Authority to build nuclear power plants throughout the state, which is something that I think hasn't been done since Robert Moses in the 1950s. So like more and more of the building trades, and this is something that I've been saying over and over because I want it to get into people's heads who are in the trades who listen to this show, more and more it feels like we're becoming public sector workers with like a go-between, which is like the private contractors and the GCs. And more like we're going to be kept on the bench as long as there's no great infrastructure money coming in, which requires, of course, like interest rate policies and funding from Biden's and Trump's and whoever's after JD Vance or whatever it is. So more and more like the unions as like an independent branch, such as they even were 20 or 30 years ago, that it seems like it's, diminishing, if not being destroyed. So I'm not sure how that complicates the question, but it makes, I think, the political questions, political and the capitalist and Democrat versus Republican, are we going to do anything about climate change or are we just going to let it fucking rip? These become interested questions for the building trades unions in specific. Life or death, existential, really.
Yeah, and I, you know, you mentioned before that you didn't want the book to be about abolishing the value form, but in a way it is. You just sort of give it a different name, which is the oil value life chain, the system of production that maximizes profit at the expense of any other social goal. And I kind of maybe piece this together in my own headcanon, but it seems like this is something you've been thinking about since you went on this Shell corporate retreat a few years ago. And I remember reading that article back then and finding it very interesting because it seemed like Shell was at a moment where they said, we have to appeal to people like Malcolm Harris and let them understand that we are, you know, ultimately not the bad guy here. Why do you think they invited you out there and made this pitch to you? And how did you feel about that pitch at the time? And how do you feel about it now?
And to be clear, it was 2018, right, Malcolm? Did I have
I think that's right. Which was a very different like historical moment, especially when it came to the climate crisis and how firms like Shell felt about the social pressure that was being pushed on them, especially in London, which is where this thing was. So Shell, the company Shell, has been doing these like long-term visioning planning sessions since sort of like Stuart Brand scammed them in the 70s, I think, into thinking like, trying to use like hippie tools for business ends, which is sort of the whole transition of the 80s, as a lot of people think of it. But one of the best examples, trademark examples of that process was Shell Oil. They're back to being Shell Oil, I think. taking these tools to try and think about, all right, how do we think about our hydrocarbon business decades into the future? And they invited me because my first book, Kids These Days, is a generational analysis. And I didn't know when I wrote that the generational analysis, the whole like subsector is a scam. It's all like advertising for consulting services, like corporate consulting services. So everyone who does generational analysis, except for me, almost everyone, their books are just advertisements for their corporate consulting services. And really they want you to like hire them to tell you about how to sell products to the generation that they write about. And they think about it mostly as like a, you know, consumer object, which is not how my book is. My book's much better than that, I promise. But some thoughtful worker at Shell said, why don't we invite this guy to
the millennial.
Right. Yeah. We're going to write about millennials. Why not actually invite the millennial who's written about millennials, which was sort of how my book was sold, as opposed to like the socialist writing about millennials. Or communist, whatever.
You're like, so in Owen Jones. That's what they thought.
Oh, I like Owen Jones is fine.
Yeah. He's also
yeah, he might make more money than I do based on doing stuff like that. I don't know. I don't want to slander Owen Jones. But a lot of people do this stuff, right? The corporate consulting pays way better. And I don't do it partly because of what happened with this one, which is that they said like, oh, you don't have to sign an NDA. I was like, oh, I can't do it because you're going to make me sign an NDA. And they said, oh, no, don't even worry about it. We don't make people sign NDAs because this like consulting work is so lucrative and easy that no one's going to like blow it up by writing an article for a magazine about what you saw and heard, which is what I ended up doing for New York Magazine about this trip and talking to these people. And honestly, like they were upset. It turned out it was like a Senate investigation subpoenaed some of these emails that leaked out, and the emails about my article internally in Shell are very funny. It's like the communications person being like, ah, right. Like he really got us, like nothing we could have done. This was his plan from the beginning. Like, rats. And then like some higher up being like, what is New York Magazine? And then the comms person is like, oh yeah, don't even worry about it. No one reads New York Magazine. It's like this like regional rag. People confuse it with the New Yorker, but like, it's not even that big a deal.
Why was there a Senate investigation about it?
It was just about Shell in general. It was just to happen to include some of the emails about my article, I guess. Someone and a journalist sent them to me, and I got a real kick out of it.
But it wasn't specifically relevant. It just like ended up in the discovery somehow.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It just ended up in this dump, but it was these emails back, internal emails about like, oh man, bummer. But at least it was just New York Magazine.
Die young or live long enough to see your work be taken apart in subpoenas from the Senate.
Exactly. Well, yeah, not a major part of the investigation, but I honestly didn't think it was like too bad for them. It was like a pretty realistic analysis of where they were corporately, strategically at that moment with regard to global warming, which is that they were figuring that millennials were going to get control of society's investment organs and divest from fossil fuels. And so that Shell had to be ready to themselves move away from fossil fuels and decarbonize, because they thought that pressure was coming, and they thought it was coming like really soon and really hard. And part of that, like genuinely part of that from talking to them, was the role of protesters. And like, this was a high point of Extinction Rebellion, especially in London. And like, they were walking around in fear. Like all of these people who work for oil companies, like half fear, half excitement, who like, they were like ready for the protesters to like bust through every door of anywhere they were sitting. And this created like a real sense of like anxiety, but also of like historical movement. It made them sense, even if like those protesters weren't going to force them to decarbonize, they realized that like that was an indication of something bigger to come, or like, so it was interesting watching from that side what they thought of like protests and stuff, which is a lot. They thought a lot of it, maybe more than they should have analytically when we look back. But so a lot of this conversation was about how they were going to decarbonize and what that was going to mean for Shell.
Yeah, I read a manual. Carrere, do you know this guy, The Guardian? Mm-hmm. He wrote a piece in The Guardian about going to the G8 or whatever. Did you read that piece? And he starts it off by saying, well, the last one of these summits I went to was back in 2017. And back then, everybody, you know, everyone would just solemnly say, yeah, we're going to have to do something about climate change. And everyone would agree, you know. But, you know, Trump was like the outlier back then. And he's like, he looks back on 2017 as like these simpler, nicer times. Mm-hmm. And now at the most recent one, everybody was terrified to talk about it because they didn't want to set Trump off. So that whole issue was just sort of tabled. And then so the new issue that he said was like that was Ukraine and Russia. Now it's, we can all say we support Ukraine against Putin's aggression, but we're worried that Trump be set off about that. And he makes this dark comment that's like, maybe in 7 years we're gonna feel like everything was so simple and easy now. And you know, he just, jeez. Yeah, it was an interesting time marker of that. And your book sort of is as well, because there was this, at least this feeling 8 years ago, that the problem was widely acknowledged, and maybe even if these summits weren't actually doing anything to seriously solve the problem, at least the problem was recognized. I think maybe from seeing the rise and fall of that moment, you sort of theorize that the fossil capital is sort of at the center of everything, at least in terms of writing the book, where the oil value life chain is sort of like class conflict by other means, you write at one point. Why do you think oil is so primary to this current political impasse we're in?
Yeah, so I talk about the thing that really stuck with me from that Shell trip that I don't even make a central part of the article, really, because it wore on me over time, was when I was asking this financial analyst at Shell, who was a young guy, around my age, whatever. I don't think he even got a job at Shell. I think Shell bought the company that he was working for, which was how Shell was dealing with a lot of like youth recruitment problems where people didn't want to work at Shell. So they would just like buy the green battery company that you do work at. And then you like have to quit your job at Shell. And so this guy wasn't going to quit his job at Shell. He like found himself working at Shell, and was moving on to the finance analyst side with the idea that this would be like a job he could continue doing even after a green transition. And so I was talking to him about what does it mean for Shell to decarbonize an oil well? Like what happens to that well? Would it, like you put a cap on it, you blow it up, like what happens? And he was like, well, no, we sell it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, well, like you sell it to who? Like to do what? And he's like, well, we'll sell it like to someone who's going to operate it cheaper than we did, which means ignoring the labor restrictions, ignoring environmental restrictions, flaring excess gas, you know, operating some criminal enterprise. I think he compared it to like the war on drugs, and you're like, yeah, it'd be like a, you know, the gasoline cartel or whatever. It'd be like these like this criminal network is going to operate these because somebody's still going to want that gasoline. And it still got value. And I was like, well, that doesn't sound like a good plan to decarbonize anything, right? In fact, the carbon intensity of that individual well is going up by Shell decarbonizing it, as far as Shell is concerned, decarbonizing. And what he said to me is, well, we don't plan to lose money. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty like obvious one. Like, of course they don't. He's a financial analyst. That's his job, is to make sure we lose money. If he was like, boss, I think we should take the L here, he'd be fired. Or if his boss was convinced and said like, you know, you're right, we should do this, then he would be fired. And if the CEO was convinced, then he would be fired, right? Like the company could disband itself, but then someone else would do that work, right? And that's what we're talking about, an impersonal problem that's not about bad leadership or like corrupt government or anything like that, but about this impersonal oil value life chain of, well, we can't plan to lose money. And if we do plan to lose money, somebody else is going to come in and plan not to lose money. And it's also true for workers themselves who are going to plan to go work at this flaring oil well, right? Wherever that flaring oil well, someone is going to go work there. And it's not because they're putting a gun to their head mostly and saying, you have to go work at this flaring oil well or I'm going to kill you. And it's not because they're going to get rich, because they're going to get paid so much money at this flaring oil well that they're going to be wealthy and it's easy to talk them into it. It's because they know, in the same way that impersonally the company doesn't plan to lose money, that they can't plan to lose money, that their access to the things that they need in order to live is based on their ability to make themselves valuable. And one good place to do that is in the fossil fuel sector. And that's it. That's an impersonal problem. That's something that every person faces individually, not because their boss is evil or because their like president is a bad person, but because this is the way our global, you know, planetary social metabolism is set up. And so that's when you talk about like value theory, that really like that's a value theory idea, right? Is about how this works.
On one hand, you have socially necessary labor time from the worker's perspective. You know, you have to get paid, you have to pay your rent, you have to make a living somehow. And on the other hand, you have the company saying, well, we have our job is to extract oil and to sell oil. And so they sort of converge in this chain. Is that more or less correct?
Yeah, well, the chain, so I talk about the chain of these three terms and how they're connected, which is that like if in our system, fossil fuels, oil in particular, is valuable, and it is, right? Because you can use them to do more work than it takes to extract them. They're very useful in a capitalist sense, which is the way we talk about useful in a capitalist sense is valuable. And if value is the system whereby we control every individual person's access to the things that they need in order to live, then oil is going, then you have this connection between these three concepts that is going to be an impersonal system that restricts your ability to make purposeful decisions about how you arrange society, right? Because if you ban, we could ban fossil fuel cars tomorrow in the United States, right? Say Trump is overthrown and we get a green dictatorship led by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tomorrow, and she decrees from the White House, which has been painted red, that all internal combustion vehicles in the United States are banned. You're not allowed to power them. We're going to spike all the, cut off all the nozzles at all the gas stations tomorrow. Like, we're not going to scrap all those cars, right? It's not like every Porsche in the United States gets piled into some monument or whatever. You put them on boats and you send them to another country where someone's going to buy them and drive them with gasoline in the tank, right? Like, we lack the ability to make those kind of decisions as a society, even if we wanted to. And if every society, every country signed on to the no cars protocol, then there would be a coup in some country and they would buy all the cars, right? Because there's too much value there in the current system in order to direct ourselves. And so each of the three strategies that I talk about are ways to try and address this problem of the oil value life chain. So I don't think communism or the shattering of the value form is the only theoretically viable answer to this problem. I think it's, for me, I think it is the answer that society, global society, will be forced to select over time or whatever. Will we be forced to do that? But I think the people who say, look, we want to build up a free, cheap, clean energy system such that fossil fuels are not worth burning. They're not worth extracting and burning anymore just within the capitalist system because energy is just so cheap everywhere. That's an analytically viable solution that could happen. That I can't say that's of a different order, unrealistic than my solution, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's still a political problem there, which is that power is still being generated by the state, if in this climate Mao, AOC climate Mao scenario. So you still have this question of power that is electric, even if it's green energy.
Yeah, one thing that I was thinking about in reading this book and then just mulling it over afterwards is we've all read Andreas Malm, obviously, Fossil Capital. Andy, have you read Fossil Capital?
I haven't read that one, no.
Oh, you got to read Fossil Capital. It's awesome.
It's very good and it's very awesome. And one of the things it points to is the, the class character of the switch from hydroelectric or not even hydro-powered factories to coal-driven, steam-driven factories, and how it was the portability and the ability for capital to move around under a coal regime in a way that it couldn't under hydropower that really compelled capitalists to make this fast change to get rid of all this, not get rid of, but basically brick slowly this fixed capital that exists and move on from that incumbency to a new form of energy. You read that story and you nod to that story, and then you realize that in the 20th century, you had similar technological innovations when it comes to the energy system. And no longer is it capitalists in their atomic way, metabolic, molecular way, making these choices based on the balance of class forces, based on how much capital they can accrue, based on profitability or perceived profitability to move. But instead, and now I'm thinking about something like Margaret Thatcher versus the coal miners in England, it becomes a deeply political. These questions of incumbency and the energy mix become deeply political by the time the 20th century comes around. Already in the mid-20th century, it becomes a matter of massive state investment in nuclear power, right? Which is supposed to solve a lot of these problems. And then by the end of the 20th century, you have these epic battles over what the energy mix is going to look like. And so I would just like to point to a progressive deepening of the implication and the difficulty of human society writ large, class society writ large, dealing with these questions of incumbency, dealing with these questions of sunk capital, and dealing with these questions of where we might rationally plan things in the future. And again, we talked about this on the podcast yesterday, Andy, like in the 90s and 2000s, even up to the Biden's semi Green New Deal, it seemed as though these questions would be solved politically. And now we're in the midst of a huge backlash. So Malcolm, a lot at you there, but that's kind of where my head went with that. And I think that it shows an increasing and progressive implication of the capitalist state, the global capitalist state, in capitalist production, especially of energy. But go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, Fossil Capital is definitely an important book for me writing this and understanding the situation. Another one that I point to is Timothy Mitchell's Carbon Democracy, which really looks at that transition from oil or from coal to oil, right? Like the fossil capital does a really good job talking about the transition from wind and water to coal. And then Timothy Mitchell in the 20th century does a great job looking, especially about the international implications of the switch to oil. And really a lot of that has to do with not wanting to deal with coal workers, right? That like coal is very labor intensive. The production is very labor intensive compared to oil. And that coal workers have use that to their advantage and exercised real sort of control over that production system, especially in the UK. And so you talk about Thatcher versus the miners, right? This is about control over that system and switching to oil, which you can bring in a giant ass tanker that only has seven people on it or whatever. That like the amount of petroleum engineers that you need to do a functioning like liquid oil system is way, way fewer than you need in terms of like coal miners to have a coal-based system. And so that transition is absolutely about labor and about control over the production process and the energy production system. So yeah, one thing I talk about a lot in the public power section is pump storage hydropower, which yes. I think is like a real, real key to the energy system. And we just like don't even talk about it here in the United States. Like not only do we not build it, pump storage hydropower, which is for listeners who are not aware, it's like basically two reservoirs of water, one higher than the other. And when you want to store more energy, you use excess energy to pump water to the higher reservoir. And then when you want to access that energy, you have it flow over a generator into the lower reservoir. And it's like 100-year-old technology, 100-plus-old technology, very simple, very durable, and very scalable. Scale's huge. It really only works when it's like really, really big. And these systems store over 90% of grid-scale energy, both in the United States and around the world. We talk about batteries a lot because there's a lot of capitalist profit and capitalist investment in batteries, but pump storage hydro numerically is where the energy is. That's where it gets stored. And again, we cannot build it in the United States, basically. There are only a few projects, even any phase of development right now. And we can't even like think about it or talk about it because the interests that would push that conversation like don't exist because these are such massive projects. You basically have to like hollow out a mountain. They're very labor intensive in terms of the building labor.
Was this the project you're talking about that they're looking into in Hawaii?
Yeah. So in West Kauai is one of the few examples of a pump storage hydro project that is going right now. Mm-hmm. And they figured out some of the environmental objections with that project. They scaled down a little bit so that it's not flowing into the water system. There were a lot of, I think, good objections about why they didn't want to flow it into the water system in Hawaii. But they're moving forward with that in Kauai. Yeah. There's a lot of sunny days in Kauai, it turns out. And one way to store solar energy is to use one of these pump storage facilities, right? Because you can pump water up using this solar power and then let it fall down. And it's very effective. And again, the crucial part is that it's durable, is that you can build these and they can last theoretically, basically forever. You can repair them pretty simply and they work indefinitely, unlike batteries, which have to be reproduced every 15 years because they die.
And it's so cool that your like battery power is just like freaking pushing water up a mountain. And then when you need it, it comes back down again. That's just dope.
Yeah, and it's like it involves a lot of reformatting of the natural world, and so you like it's true that it involves a lot of destruction because you're building these things, but it doesn't. But like long term, it's not a damaging facility in terms of the environment. So you can like build a nature preserve around one of these things. in a way that you can't with like nuclear power, for example.
I don't want to derail anything, but one job I was on last year was pulling down. There was a demolition of a 110-year-old cogeneration plant by Con Ed. Cogeneration, for people who aren't familiar, is the steam power, which I think came from gas. I think it was a gas steam plant that produced electricity. The steam was then used to heat buildings. After it went through the turbines, it then went through massive vents, basically, under the East River and into Manhattan. If you've seen like Taxi Driver, where all the steam's coming up from the streets, those are those vents that get opened up sometimes.
Is that still where the New York City steam comes from? Is that still what that is?
We have district heating in large parts of Manhattan. We wouldn't know because we, you know, don't live in Manhattan. But if you're there and you're like a big commercial property developer, a lot of your heat comes from, and hot water comes from this system, which basically runs vents all through the city.
I always thought that was just some like mystical Manhattan force coming out from the vents, like Ghostbusters.
It is. Style. It's the 20th century breathing into the.
It's the 20th century, specifically Ghostbusters 2, if people remember that, the slime under the streets. But anyways, yeah, I was working this project. They were taking apart the cogeneration plant, and we were dealing with the soil stratum there to kind of stabilize the soil on this demo area so that you could put a slab, a big concrete slab in, so you could put a series of huge batteries. I'm thinking to myself now, based, Malcolm, on what I read in your book and what we've been speaking about, why would they do batteries and not hydro pump storage of energy? And I think it's probably because of watersheds. Like the closest place to do that would probably be up in the Catskills, where all of our beautiful fresh water comes from. So New York State is doing like a sort of egregious developmentalist thing where they're trying to create an entire kind of green energy network, like up from Albany all the way down the Hudson River, to try to like grasp like this green energy tradition for the state itself. So I imagine these batteries are to get the energy from offshore wind that we're also building, get that into Brooklyn and then distribute it as needed. But I thought it was very interesting that like my life is intersecting with what was promised to be this like massive transition, right? With the IRA and the CHIPS Act. And yet we're living through right now a real backlash. So maybe that tempers the way that we read your book and understand it. What do you think about this backlash, Malcolm?
Yeah. When the book came out, people were like, okay, so does like the Trump administration and their just gutting of the IRA and all of these market craft strategic pieces of legislation, as well as regulations and all the, like, really going after green market craft as a strategy from within the government. Does that mean that like that strategy is worse than the other strategy now? Do we have to like lean towards the other strategies? And my answer was sort of like, I wish I could just say that one is bad now. But the truth is like,
communism's back on the menu.
Communism's back, and now things are going to be better for us. And it's like, well, that's not like,
that certainly wasn't Adam Tooze's. Yeah. That's certainly not what Adam Tooze said in his review.
I'm not sure Adam Tooze would write the same review today that he wrote at the time.
Interesting. Yeah.
I would be surprised if he rewrote that review, because I think it was responding to a very particular moment and the inability to think about that. I mean, that was the subhead of the review, was like, I can't think about anything right now, which.
Yeah. He, I mean, just to
bummer,
just to sum that up for the audience, it seemed like he was saying, oh, these ideas are all very nice, but the struggle now is to defend basic civil liberties. And that's all we can think about. We can't think about the planetary crisis at all. That's sort of what I came away from the review saying.
Right. But like, if you look at what he's written since then, it's all back on the same stuff. You know, it's like
he had some temporary Trump derangement syndrome, I guess.
Yeah. For 5 minutes. Well, and again, like for him as someone who writes about this kind of thing, you could read it as him thinking about his own position or whatever. I don't think it was like much of an engagement with the book itself. And I think he would agree with that. It was about his feelings at the moment, which is too bad for me, but that's how these things go, I suppose. you try not to take it personally. But yeah, I wish I could say that just like the market crash strategy is fucked now. And so we could either do socialism and communism and those are only two choices or whatever. But obviously like the rise of a right wing government is going to have bad impacts for every part of the left. And I don't think there's a part of the left that's like advantaged by the second Trump administration. And you can see this by like, so public power wise, you see the attack on organizing ability, all the progress that was made under Biden around like the NLRB and stuff. He's trying to hamper and maybe even like destroy the NLRB as a whole. But also even like public power institutions that are like a century old or whatever, almost that are from the Roosevelt era, whether it's the like the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Bonneville Power Authority, are being gutted by the federal government. Like these are actually existing bastions of public power where the federal government, Trump administration is like pulling directors so that they don't have quorum to operate and stuff like that. So obviously they have the power to undermine that strategy as well. And then the third strategy, I wish I could say, and that's why everyone has to be a communist because our only choice right now is like, our only like viable strategy right now is rebellion against the system and like uprising and insurrection. But they've very quickly turned, to a like martial crackdown on the left, right? The use of deportations specifically around the student movement and the campus movement.
Yeah. And unions.
Like that's and unions, yeah, like specifically. And that's a classic anti-communist strategy, right? Going to like the Palmer raids and the first Red Scare is like, there's a disproportionate amount of immigrants on the left, right? Like that's not everyone knows that. It's not surprising. And you can target even among leadership, we can say, and the government can target those people for removal. And I do think that's part of the beginning of what's going to be a pretty clear attack on the left by the security forces that I think that all that ICE money, if it actually turns out to be real and they really start spending it, they're going to need more targets than they have. And I think we're on that list pretty high.
My father went, hey Dad, my father went to Canada recently and out of a fit of paranoia, perhaps he changed my name on his phone as though nice. They were gonna, like, look at his phone and be like, oh, you're the father of our suspect. We're going to take you down.
Apparently Canada's chiller because they're the only place that does customs on the Canadian side of the border. So like that when you're dealing, you're still dealing with like U.S. customs or whatever, but it's U.S. customs in Canada, which is a little different or whatever. But like, I wouldn't bring my phone if I was traveling internationally right now. I just wouldn't.
No, they say you're supposed to sign out of all your social media.
Sign and shit. Yeah. I just like, and that's, I went to Moscow a while ago, like, you know, maybe 10 years ago, I got invited to go talk about my first book by this actually like landscape architect group. It was really cool. I'd never been out there.
Did you see Lenin?
I got to spend a couple of days, but I didn't bring my phone. I like knew not to bring my phone. And that was like the context of like that government is that like, if you walk into that state with your phone, that the government's going to own it. And there could be negative implications.
You didn't bring your weed either, did you?
No, I didn't. That's true. That is one of the few trips. That I did not. I didn't bring shit. I did not have the best time. I did not enjoy Moscow to the fullest, I don't think.
I was going to say too, that like, little did you know that there's probably liberals out there who think that that's when the Putin regime turned you. And that's when you like an agent like Donald Trump, you know, so you're here to subvert us or something.
It is interesting those sort of like heuristics that people use to make sense of different people's positions. And I feel like I hope that those people have a hard time reading this book because I really try not to make it easy for anybody. Cause I do think like, you look like Iranian flagged fishing boats have done serious damage off Yemen and Somalia to the like fish populations in those areas to the detriment of the people who live in Yemen and Somalia. Like, that's true. Does that make like Iran the enemy of free thinking people everywhere or something? Like, no, like that's not the argument that I'm making, but like, this is real. Like the coal fired power plants have affected the environmental quality in Xinjiang. Like that's just true. Like, does that make me a like anti-China, like, not absolutely not. In the same way that I think talking realistically about, like, successes that Venezuela and Cuba and North Korea have had in, like, farming practices doesn't make me a, like, tanky or whatever. Like, we need to be able to, like, think critically about all of these things in the proper context, whatever. I don't think it would be right politically correct for me to be like, you know, the real problem here is China, because I think that's, like, wrong, right? I think that's, like, incorrect.
Well, I want to ask you about that too, because there's sort of in, like, leftist debates over, like, what to do about the climate crisis, some people point to one graph about China and say, like, look, China's going in the right direction, and then someone will respond with another graph saying, no, it's actually much worse. What's your take on China in terms of CO2 emissions and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're the real green capitalists in the world, right? And I think that's the like moderate position, or that's like it should be the dominant position. And I think it is at a certain level. I think if you put a gun to Jake Sullivan's head, theoretically, and you asked him about, like, China and what they were really doing and, like, green capitalism or whatever, like, he would say the same thing, right? Like, China's really good at green capitalism. That is one of the strategies, and that's one of the things I talk about. So, like, when I talk about market craft strategies, China is the gold standard for market craft strategies. Like, no one has been nearly as successful at programming the economy, the capitalist economy, to produce the things that are socially required as China has, right? Mm-hmm. That includes electric vehicles, it includes solar panels, but it also includes pumped storage hydropower, like I talked about. It includes trees. They're planting trees at a rate that the world has never seen. Reforestation, afforestation, China is killing it.
Not to mention the wonderful trains.
Yeah, trains, absolutely. Oh my God. Every leftist in the world fucking shoot ourselves in the head just to take one of those trains.
Like, I thought about, in terms of China, I think about this backlash as, like, incredibly self-defeating. And if there was maybe, like, one way to imagine defeating the power, the incumbent power of both fossil fuels and internal combustion engines in this country, it would be open the borders to commodities, to capital. Allow BYD to sell $11,000 electric SUVs in this country and solar panels at, like, cost plus, like, 5% profit or something like
that.
Don't let your
union brothers hear you say that, man. Like, get your ass in trouble.
Directly threatening auto jobs and threatening the job that I did, like, 10 years ago, building a natural gas power plant upstate. But the point is, like, maybe that's what's necessary. That is a capitalist solution to a capitalist problem. But, like, it is telling, I think, that this reaction this backlash that we're in right now has a nationalistic sheen to it, for exactly that reason, that it's only by putting up tariffs, by putting up sanctions, by putting up banning new technologies, that America, as this incumbent, is able to get away with these very regressive energy policy and to try to keep alive this fossil fuel industry, which by all rights should be dying, should be dead.
Yeah, Sean, you should get a little China flag sticker for your helmet that says "Buy Chinese" on it.
I put it right next to the I've got a golden eagle, but it's made out of an American flag. I'll put that on one side, and then I'll put the Chinese flag on the other, and then, like, the drill sergeant will be like, "What's the meaning of those stickers on your helmet?" I'll say, "It's something about the duality of man, sir." Yeah.
The workers of the world unite.
All right.
Must unite with the Chinese workers.
I want to end the episode with a couple questions, moving on from actually existing socialism to actual socialism or actual communism. Some of your ideas from the end of the book. Would you guys want to take a little break before we do that?
No. Let's go on.
Okay. That's right. All right. So, yeah, you end the book.
Hey folks, Sean KB here. Just a reminder that our show relies on your support. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to hear more excellent bonus content, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada. It's cheap, there's a ton of content, and it would mean everything to us. So thank you, and we'll see you behind the paywall. Action.